We are now audio recording, so the recording as well as the deck will and the contents of the chat window will go up on our website later on this evening, courtesy of Alan's hard work. And I think that we can kick it off right away. So again, welcome all, and I'll kick it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck. Alan, it's all yours.
Okay, thanks, Chris.
You going to go into slideshow mode?
This is slideshow mode, isn't it?
Okay, I'm seeing your. It's
yeah. There's a reason for that, which will become clear in a second.
Oh, okay.
we started off a couple of days ago. There was absolutely nothing in the pipe, but things have brightened up in the last day. So we've got quite a few different things, which I think you'll find interesting. However, one of the things we had lined up, which we haven't got round to, is this, looking for your suggestions for topics for presentations at our monthly meetings or things that you'd like to see discussed or demonstrated at these Q&A sessions. We've asked a number of times for people's suggestions, and there's been articles in the newsletter. But I thought tonight we'd actually do a bit of brainstorming. And here's the items that I have listed already, which have been requested. I mentioned the history of USB connections. There was interest in the history and how all these things are used these days. Somebody wants a demonstration or an outline, an overview of Audacity, which is a freeware sound recording program. You can use it for recording from a microphone or over the internet. And then you can also edit sound files. And it's quite a powerful little program. So if anybody is a guru on Audacity, then you want to give a short share on how it all works and maybe give a demonstration, and we'd like to hear from you. And most recently, somebody's pointed out that most email clients use folders to categorize your mail and store things in a kind of a logical sequence. Gmail doesn't use folders, it uses something called labels. And he was interested in an explanation of what labels are, how they differ from real folders, and maybe a demonstration. So those are the three items we've got in the pipe. I left the chat window open here, so I'm now asking for your suggestions. So anything you want to tell us, put it in the chat, or open your microphone and just talk us through it. So now I'm going to wait for a little while and see how many things I get to add to my list.
And certainly in addition to that, we'd be happy to put sub-bullet points with names beside them for the existing items if you want to volunteer to do one of the existing topics. I'm halfway through a deck already on Gmail labels. That's why Alan knew that. And so I'm happy to do that. However, if somebody else feels themselves to be a guru, I'm only halfway through. So if you wanted to take it over, I'm happy to give it up.
I could do a little more on FUBAR. I use it to reduce the size of audio files by reducing the frequency range and by compressing it.
As a question, how many folks, you know, Chris put this in the newsletter years ago, I mentioned it before, and how many folks use the screen capture stuff? I like the green shot, and I used to use it at work almost all day for little things and even quick little notes and that I delete. Do many folks use the screen shot thing, and would that be something you're interested in?
I use snipping tool. I use it all the time.
I think a demo of GreenShot would be really good because anybody who only uses The snipping tool could certainly see some additional capabilities with GreenShot.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Let's put your name next to it, you know.
I heard another voice in the background there.
I was just going to ask, my name's Allison. I use a snipping tool too on my work computer. But sort of on that note, I was wondering if anybody uses anything for screen captures, but like to film a video. I know my son uses, there is one that comes with Microsoft 10, I believe, and he uses that. It works to varying degrees, but I was just wondering if anyone uses anything else for that.
I've actually used Debian, which is, I think, freeware for a personal use. But most of the time, I use Linux, and I use a simple screen recorder, which is a free program and works really well. But it's a Linux utility.
Yeah, I use Debian as well quite often. And there's another one, Screen Hunter Pro, which you can either take a static screenshot or you can record a video off the screen. And you can set the area that you're covering in both the programs.
Sorry, what was it called?
Screen Hunter Pro.
How about, Alan, if you put the video recording ones as item 6, and we'll leave screen capture as a for static images?
I use ShareX for static images. I believe it has a way to create a movie, but I haven't used that, so I don't know how to. The reason I like ShareX is that you can choose to immediately open it in a file editing program, a picture editing program after that. So I open it in Irfan View, and then I can do any particular stuff I need to do, which is usually reducing the number of colors and the size, so I can send it places.
I use Snagit for mostly for static images. It does do screen recording as well. However, it does cost $65 Canadian at retail, but it's got some really powerful features. If you do a lot of screen capturing type stuff and inserting into documents and other places like that, it has some extremely powerful features. Potentially I could do that, but being a $65 package, I'm not sure how many people are interested in spending that kind of money for screen capture.
ShareX is very powerful.
I was doing a video capture recently with the PowerPoint, and I was getting frustrated because I couldn't, and Chris tried to help me, but we couldn't figure out how to get rid of my little face in the bottom corner. That should not be the default. But anyway, so I've used that. But
I use, if I absolutely have to, just the simplest thing is to take out my smartphone and take a picture of whatever it is I'm looking at.
Well, what that's really handy for is when you get a blue screen or something like that, and you're not about to use software to do a screen capture when you've got a blue screen.
I'm just pointing out, I don't have any familiarity with software for these things, because my instance of needing it is so rare that to remember how to do it would take me so long to figure out that I just say, crap, grab my smartphone, take a picture.
Well, wait till you see Bob Hare's presentation on GreenShot. GreenShot is really easy to use, but it's got a lot of depth to it as well.
I use ShareX all the time to create different pictures from stuff that's on the screen. It's really convenient. You can do the whole window. You can do all your windows, assuming you have multiple monitors. And you can also do a portion of it. Usually I just do a portion. It's very easy to mark it out with your cursor and share that. and then it immediately opens in the editor and you can do stuff with it, reduce its, fine tune the edges or reduce the number of, number of colors in it. I often go down to 256 or 16 different colors, and that's usually enough for most screenshots.
So is that program called ShareF?
Yes, I put a link in the chat. It's called ShareX, and the website is getsharex.com. And you can also, I mean, it has many more facilities that I don't use. You can share things to different destinations, from Pinterest to other stuff. But I just use just little bits of it.
So, Alan, that's not an F on the end. That's an X.
X.
Yeah.
Yes, it's share X as in extra or X-ray.
Right. And the one that Linda was using, that you were using PowerPoint for video capture?
Right. Yes.
Didn't know you could do that.
Yep. Kevin Stratford shows you how.
That's how Kevin, what would we do without him?
Yeah, that's how I learned about it.
Okay, anything else? Got a few things there. But...
okay, if anybody thinks about those items that don't have a name beside them, then I guess you could put, for number four, you could put Tom down on that. But if anybody else has something that they'd like to contribute to those or additional topics, by all means, send them into suggestion box at opcug.ca.
That's FUBAR 2000, I should specify.
Okay. Okay, all right, moving on then. Now you've got a copy of this slide deck, Chris.
Yep.
The internet's dropped out on me a couple of times tonight already.
Okay, yeah, I've got
okay, so the first real share we have is from Chris, so I'll turn it over to him.
Yeah, this is just came out yesterday, news about this, the latest version of Windows 10. Which is called 21H1 for the first half of 2021. And it's available now to all people that are on 2004 or later, which also means 20H2, and only to seekers. So you actually have to go to Settings, Update, and Security and do a check for updates. And if your machine is deemed worthy, you will get a prompt that you can download and install it. It's very, very minor. It goes in really quick. For me, from the time that I clicked, yes, go ahead, download and install, until the time I was rebooted and logged back in was under 5 minutes. There is an ISO available for download, apparently. I don't have the URL to that, but the article at the bottom probably has a link within it where you could actually download the ISO as well or find it on Microsoft's website. I personally recommend that you don't install from an ISO. Wait until you're offered it under Windows Update, because apparently there are still some blocks in place for some hardware devices, and you will only be offered it through Windows Update if you your machine is deemed up to snuff for it. Very little new in it. I don't know if I'd bother going recommending anybody actually bother going and seeking it out anyways. For most people, I think you just wait until it's offered to you, whenever it happens, and then install at that point in time, you'll be perfectly fine. If you're interested in learning more about it, Mary Jo Foley of All About Microsoft, she has a page on the information, what's in it, how to get it, and where and so forth. So if you're interested, go there and read up on it.
And just looking at that list, Chris, I don't use Hello. I don't use Edge. Group policy is probably only available for Pro or something.
Yep.
What's the Windows Defender application card?
And that's essentially in I think it really only applies to enterprise customers. Huh. So it's additional capabilities that, and most of our users are not going to actually be interested in it. So, or they won't get any of those benefits. So.
No, that doesn't apply to me either. So.
Yeah.
Okay, I won't be seeking that, I guess.
No.
All right. Our first question of the night is waiting for an answer. Stuart wants to know if anybody's heard of Mixplora. It's an Android file manager. It's supposed to have been around for 10 years, and he wants to know if it's any good. I looked it up on Windows on the Android Google Play Store, and now it's available as Mixplora Silver, which is a combination of the file manager and another one of his products. And he wants you to buy it for $4.49. And his original Mixplora, there is a website. It's got tons of different features, tab browsing, dual panel, HTML and PDF viewers, advanced search capabilities and so forth. And he says it has no adverts and it is and will always remain free. So this is the Mix Explorer kind of baseline version, if you like, not the silver edition. And this version is not available in the Play Store. And that's all I know about it. So has anybody else come across that and you know if the product is as good as it's advertised? Open your mic and tell me, or put something in the chat, or we'll assume that Stuart's never going to find the answer because nobody knows. And he'll have to go and demo it for us. Well, again, if you do know, the chat window's open all night, so I'll send us an email, whatever. Okay, our next thing is a share, and it's from Jocelyn. And Joss is going to share his screen, I believe, and go through his own deck.
All right. I think that everybody can hear me.
Yep.
All right. Basically, I was looking for a software to do music notation. I was trying to learn how to play a keyboard, and I cannot read music myself, so I was trying to help me with a software that I can enter the notes and I can play the notes. So, and I found a very nice software called MuseScore. It's available for free on the internet. Okay, there it is. So there are two different, so it's on, the website is MuseScore.org. And you can download it for free. It's 107 megabytes, so it's a small one, but it's a very, very powerful software if you want to enter your notes and play your music. There is also a commercial side to that program. The .com is the commercial side, and there are thousands and thousands of score that are already entered. So you can search for them and download them if you want. There are some that are, you have to pay for it, and there are some that are public domain, so you can download them and get them to load into a MuseScore. So up to you. All right. It's why using MuseScore? It has pretty much everything you can think of in how to enter music and a sheet. It's completely free and there is no limitation. It's easy to use, but well, I don't know about that one. Depends on where you want to go. The basics are easy, but it can get very complicated also depending on what you want to enter. It's open source and it supports a MIDI keyboard. So if you have a keyboard or any instrument that has a MIDI connector, you can connect it and download and get enter the notes using that interface. And also it supports multiple formats. So if you want to load the files from other programs and different formats, so again, that's what you can do. When you install the software, when it starts, you are offered to get a tour of the, a tour of all the different features. So, and depending, and it keeps coming back. When you start for the first time a new feature, the tour comes back and it will show you a few tutorial about that particular feature that you are trying to use for the first time. Very handy for a new user. So when you want to start a new score, you simply click on the plus, and it goes through a wizard, so you can enter the title and the composer and all that stuff. You can, and once the next, when you click next, then you can choose what clef you want to use, what kind of music you want to use. So the choices are, there are hundreds of different choices again. It's good for the beginners, but it's also really good also for the pros, I think. So, as you go through the wizard, you need to select the key signature, the time signature, the number of bars, and so on. And there, and when you, so it will open the a screen where you can enter your notes. I will do a little demo at the end, so I will just show you a little bit of, more in detail what it means. But to start entering notes, you click on this button to start the entry of the notes. You select what note you want, and you simply use your mouse and you enter the note where you want it. You can use your mouse. You can use also your keyboard. So every notes have their own key. Same thing with the timing and the silence and all that kind of stuff. And you can change the tempo also. So if you click on the note and then change the tempo. So on this left side, you have a lot of different things you can enter into a music score. I won't go into that very much because there's so much in there. Then once you have entered the note, you can enter the lyrics. You can enter one line, multiple lines. It will automatically put the right speed, it will align, every syllable will align with the note. If it is one word, it will put you can put a dash. If it's a different word, then you can put a space. Yeah, that's about it. You can also edit the staff. For example, you can delete staff or add more staff. You can put the bar lines at the, so to indicate this is the end of the score. You can add the repeat, and there is so many choices again that it's just amazing. Once you have entered your music, then you can play it. So you simply click on play, and it will play your music. You can change the tempo by changing. So you click on that thing, and you change a different number, and it will change the speed of the thing. You can have a metronome if you are trying to learn the practice. Your skill for playing your music. You can repeat. Yeah, that's about it. You can change also the pitch. So depending on your voice, you can go up and down. So there is tools. There's different tools. One of them is to transpose, so you can go up and down, so you can adjust the pitch height of your voice to adapt to your voice. As you can see here, you can enter simple score or you can enter a very complicated score. For example, the Fifth Symphony of who did that one? Beethoven. And so you can see there's a lot of details you can enter. So we're just, we'll try to do a little demo here quickly.
And before you do that, there are a couple of questions.
Yes.
One was, Micheline wants to know, how do you enter sharps and flats on the keyboard?
You simply click on this, and then you enter it. So, for example, if I went to that, and...
You're not sharing your screen right now, well, so...
I'm not?
Well, we're still seeing UNAN.
Oh, okay, sorry. Okay, let me switch screen here. Where's Zoom? Let's see.
The ever puzzle to find Zoom controls.
Yeah. Okay. Is that better?
Just a second.
Okay. So you simply
just a second. They're seeing it. Okay.
Okay. So you simply enter the sharp in the and those things. You enter it beside the note.
You basically drag it down from the menu then.
Yeah. Exactly. So you can, for example, if you have a dotted note, so you enter this one and you turn on the dot. So it gives you one period and a half.
And then the second question was, how much does the program cost? But since it's open source, I guess it's free, right?
Yeah, it's totally free. What can cost money is if you want to download already made score. Music score. Those, depending on what it is, some are public domain, some are not. But the software itself is totally free. It's and there are two different websites. One is the .org, and the other one is .com. Okay.
Yes.
So, okay. So basically, if you want to enter a note, for example, you enter in edit mode. And you click the note, and you simply move up and down, and enter your note, and enter your note. And when you finish, you can just click on the first one, and then click on play. Oh, jeez, my play is hidden by Zoom here. Okay, there it is. Do you understand the music?
Yep.
Okay, let me try that again. You did hear the music?
Yep.
Yes.
Oh, okay, good. Sorry. So, okay. So, and then you can play, you can get pretty fancy music, for example, this one. And there it is. So for those that likes to play with music, I recommend that software very much.
Very cool, Josh. Thanks. We did have a comment from Allison that she was taking a music theory course, and the professor recommended Finale. And I looked it up and posted the link to the site on there, apparently free notation software. So if people want to try out multiple things, you've got at least two that you can try.
Yeah, I'm not too sure that Finale is that free. I think it's more closed software.
That might be. There's a free trial according to their website. And when I did a Google on Finale, it came up saying free Finale. It's a 30-day trial.
Yeah, so I think there's a limited time where this one is totally free, so there's no time limit.
Yeah, Jocelyn, will your software do guitar chord charts as well?
Yes. The number of type of instrument, you can have multiple instruments, and there's it's very, very complete, very complete.
Okay, thanks very much, Jocelyn.
All right, thank you.
Okay, so we should be back to my deck now. Okay, so this item started off life as a follow-up because we were talking about sharing drives over networks, and somebody mentioned sharing a USB drive on their router. And then it was going to be a share. I was going to show you how to do it. But now it's turned out to be a question. So here we go. And you can see here my router, the one that keeps dropping out. And you can see in the very top of the back there are two USB ports. And you can probably see that I plugged in one of these micro USB drives. Just a little half-inch kind of deal, which sticks out only by about a quarter of an inch out of the unit. But that's a 64 gig USB drive. So for test purposes, that's quite adequate. Basically, to use it over the network, you have to enable USB sharing on the router. So to do that, you would log into the administration panel, find the USB storage, and make sure that sharing was enabled. You also need to know the IP address, you'll see in the admin panel, or you can use the IP config command in Windows, in a command window, and it will show you your default gateway IP address. And once you have that, then you can use the run command in the search window and open the connection by putting in double backslash and then the IP address, which for my particular router is 192.168.0.1. And that basically makes the connection to this this USB drive. And then in Windows, you can actually right-click on the drive and assign it a drive letter. So I assigned it to be drive Z. Or at least I was going to, but I started off with a problem. And the problem was, when I tried to connect to the IP address, Windows pops up this message saying that I can't use SMB1, the file sharing protocol, because it's unsafe and could expose the system to attack, and it needs SMB2 or higher, i.e. SMB2 or SMB3, and go and read this link from Microsoft to find out all about it. So I enabled, by using PowerShell commands, if you look on the web, you'll find out how to do this. By using a PowerShell command, I was able to enable SMB2, and then I disabled SMB1 because SMB1 isn't safe and could expose my system to attack. So I enabled SMB2, tried to make the connection, but then Windows fails to connect the share. And so clearly it's telling me up here, it's telling me the right thing, that this share, i.e. this USB on the router, requires SMB1 protocol, which is unsafe. So what I did was, because I'd activated SMB2, I activated SMB1 and SMB2, and then tried to make the connection to see what, and sure enough, it connected. But when I run the get SMB connection command in PowerShell, it tells me that this share, which is the USB drive, the share is using dialect 1.5. Now, to me, that says that it's closer to SMB1 than it is to SMB2. So it must be using a version of SMB1, which isn't secure. However, that's the only way the thing will work. So my question is, does that mean that my router only supports SMB1 and doesn't support SMB2? In which case, since it's not a secure sharing option, I won't be using it. But is that what it means? Does anybody understand SMB protocols? And the only thing I've read on the web is that when two devices connect, they use the highest level of dialect that they both understand. So one of the devices only understands SMB1 is my guess.
Yeah.
My guess is that's the router.
That's the way I would interpret it as well, Alan, is that the router itself only talks SMB1 or 1.5, I guess. The one thing I would try, I guess, is see if there is an update to the firmware for your router, because they may have fixed that and added SMB2 as a capability.
Yeah, I couldn't find anything on the web browsing for a Hytron modem and SMB2 and stuff like that.
You're with TechSavvy, right?
Maybe I'll try the manufacturer's website and see if there's anything there.
Yeah, did you get your router? You're with TechSavvy, right?
Yeah, this came from TechSavvy.
So yeah, I would inquire to their tech support and say, you know, what do they know about it? Because they've probably come across this exact problem and know, you know, the answer as to whether it's fixable or no, that's it, or whether they can swap out the modem for another one or another modem router, swap it out for another one that does support SMB2, maybe. Yeah.
Wendy's asking if I have a separate router from the modem, and no, it's a combination unit, so both devices are in the same box. It's kind of a pity, because one of the neat things is that when you have the share running on the very insecure SMB1, not only can I see it on my laptop and my desktop, I can also see it on my Android phone. So that means it would give me another way of being able to transfer files to and from my phone. Anyway, that's kind of me.
Yeah, well, one thing I would also consider, too, is that as long as your network is secure, do you really care if you enable SMB1? Maybe the risk is actually quite low. You know, if you're only going to be compromised, or if you only could be compromised if one of your devices gets compromised, they could then use SMB1. To do something, but if your computer's already compromised, you know, all bets are off anyways. It's not like you're exposing SMB1 to the internet.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what's connected to what. When I stuff the USB into the router, is it just my network that can see it?
Yeah, it'd be on the private side for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I could interject. I think it really depends on the router's manufacturer. When I tried it on mine, it just worked. I didn't have to do anything. It appeared on my Windows network.
So your router would be exposing SMB2 then, or using SMB2 as opposed to SMB1. So,
okay, sure. Yeah. I don't know.
It must be if Windows 10 can see it in its default config, then it's not using SMB1, because definitely Windows 10 will argue vehemently that, oh, this is a terrible thing to do. Mm-hmm. And as a general rule, in terms of a computer that is exposed, you know, anywhere, SMB1 is not a good thing to expose to the world. But on a private network, I'm not sure it's that big a deal. I personally probably wouldn't be overly concerned about it, because I figure my personal network is secure enough that nobody is going to see that outside of the computers that I've allowed to join my network.
Yeah. And when I originally tried it, the port was only intended for a printer and only meant to be seen internally on my network.
Yeah.
So in the time that's passed, the firmware updates to my router have, that little section for the USB port has grown into an entire media center.
Wow.
Which I've never looked at, because, I mean, well, I've seen it, but I said, God, I don't need another media center to try and figure out.
Good point.
But it can be made available to the outside world, too, if I choose.
Well, oh, sure, you can. But, I mean, you can do all kinds of things that are unadvisable on a router.
Yeah, but going back to it, with Alan's router, I've heard, I've never had one, so I don't know, but I've heard that ISP provided modem router combinations basically suck for all kinds of reasons. Configuration, strength, and maybe you could just try picking up a cheap Wi-Fi router and continue using the one you've got as the modem.
Yeah. What, yeah, I don't know where it's good.
But you could try throwing a rock at it, too.
I'm sure the modems are not top quality. To be quite honest, I'm on my third modem. Two of them have stopped working and replaced, so it's clearly not top of the line equipment.
And it sounds like your current one isn't working all that well either. You keep dropping.
Well, it's either that or the Rogers cable connection. I'm not sure which. Tom wants to know what TechSavvy's prices are. I don't know the exact numbers offhand. It's slightly cheaper than Bell and Rogers. It's a little bit more expensive than it was because the CRTC were listening to a complaint because they'd rolled back the price, and the big guys had complained, but I think now they've sorted that out. But I haven't seen any reduction in TechSavvy's prices again since then. It's easy enough to find out. Just log on to their website, and they'll tell you exactly.
Can I say that I had a little bit of a different problem when I plugged in a USB into my wireless Linksys router. I made sure that the firmware was updated. It was on an automatic update, so that might be something to try on. But when I plugged in the USB with files already on it, I ultimately couldn't see those files. But I did see that the router itself had written three different files onto it. So then when I disconnected that USB and brought it back to my machine, and then I put some more files on it and then went back to the router, I could then see those files. But it seems to me that the original ones that I plugged into the, that were on the flash drive, before those other three router written files were on there, they are invisible. It's only what I added after those files came out.
That's truly bizarre.
Yeah, that is strange, because I had kind of the opposite problem. I had files on the stick already, and they did show up when I made the share. So.
Okay, I didn't, yeah.
Don't understand.
And, my TechSavvy is about $60 a month.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Glenn's asking, how do you share using Linux? I don't know because I've never tried. Anybody use Linux and knows how to do file sharing? And we can certainly look that up for next time. Stuart, did you have a question, comment? Oh. Did somebody else?
Maybe just a comment. If some people on the private network are not all trustworthy. For example, let's say you have kids that download anything and everything, then the security that normally you would get in the private network might not work anymore.
Yeah, good point. Good point. Yeah.
Fortunately, I don't have that problem, Justin.
Yeah.
But so, okay. Most routers have guest networks, and you could easily put less trustworthy participants on the guest network and just restrict the heck out of them.
I'm not sure you'd be able to restrict their access to the flash drive, though.
Yeah, I don't know, to be honest. It would probably vary by manufacturer.
With this Linksys, you can restrict the guest access.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. That's good. Yeah. They're thinking.
Okay, moving along, we're sticking with the Wi-Fi security aspect, and Chris, a couple of questions came in on this for you, I believe.
Yeah, let me find the right window to share. Yeah, I'm just finding the right one to share. And where is it? Jeez. Yeah, PowerPoint. There we go. That's the right one to share. Too many windows open. Okay, so a question came in. Somebody had come to one of my presentations on tips for running a secure enough wireless network at home. And I've given this a couple of times, I think, at the PC user group, and I've given it quite a few times at the Ottawa Public Library. So he had some questions about it. He had questions about Wi-Fi protected setup and about ensuring firewall is on and remote administration is off. So the first question was, in the guidance that I gave, I suggested that it was a good idea to disable WPS, Wi-Fi protected setup, due to vulnerabilities. And his question was, can you tell me why this is a vulnerability and, you know, of concern? And the answer really comes down to the fact that there is a security vulnerability in WPS. WPS works on an 8-digit number, which if you're looking at brute forcing something, you think an 8-digit number has a lot of combinations to it. But in actual fact, because they split the number in two, they use one number for checksumming and some other things like that, it turns out that there are only 11,000 unique combinations of numbers that somebody has to try in order to get connected onto a WPS-enabled network. That's trivial for a computer to run through 11,000 possible password combinations. The 8-digit number is often printed on a sticker on the bottom of the modem. So if you have somebody who has a friend maybe and they're no longer a friend, they might have seen that sticker and have access to your network if they use that 8-digit number. And in some cases, you can change the number from what is printed on that sticker, and there may be some that don't allow you to change it, so you're sort of stuck with that. So if you have that means of connecting to the WPS by using that 8-digit number, I say for sure you want to disable it because it's just too easy to hack it. Now, there are some routers that have a WPS button on it. Okay, so it'll be either on the top or the front or somewhere. And the button is designed so that when you press that, it enables WPS, but only for a couple of minutes, just long enough that you can go to your remote device, whether it's a computer or a TV or a fridge or whatever, and say, I want to connect to the network, and WPS is enabled enough, long enough that you can actually get that connection to happen. If you have that, it's probably safe to leave WPS enabled as long as you only allow it to connect through the WPS button and not through that 8-digit number that will still be, in all likelihood, enabled in WPS as well. So you have to be able to make sure that the 8-digit number technique is actually disabled. My question is WPS really needed? When you are connecting a device to a wireless network, you get prompted for the passcode, and you have to put it in once. Is it really that big a deal to just leave WPS disabled and put in that password once on every device that is connecting to your network? It's your call, but I think because one vulnerability was found in WPS, that's enough for me to say, you know, I don't really need to use it, and so therefore I'll leave it disabled. But again, it's your call. If there's a WPS button, you're probably safe if you use only that. So next question was that with WPS turned on and going to turn it off, it said turning off WPS will also disable the WPS button on your modem. And should that be a concern? And really, no. What it's telling you is that if you disable WPS in the router, the WPS button isn't going to work. That makes sense. I mean, you've disabled WPS, so pressing that button is not going to do anything for you. So I don't think that's of concern at all. The next question was about firewall. The guidance was to ensure firewall is on, and the question was, is this referring to the Windows firewall? And no, it's actually, I was referring to the firewall as built into the router. It should be on by default. I've never seen a router where it wasn't on by default, but it's a good idea to verify it. Trust but verify. And I say, make sure your Windows firewall is on too. I mean, that's good protection for you. Layered protection is always a good thing when it comes to security, and it will actually protect your computer from others on the same network. So again, you know, if your kid's computer and they're downloading anything and you figure that might be a compromised computer, then it might attack your computer. So at that point, the firewall that's built into the router isn't going to help you because you're on the same side of the network. Okay, so make sure your Windows firewall is on as well. Fortunately, with Windows, it'll argue vehemently if you don't have a firewall in effect, and it'll tell you that you've got a problem, click here to fix the problem, and it'll turn on the Windows firewall if you follow through with that. The last point was about remote administration, and the guidance was to ensure that remote admin is disabled. And the question was, is this in the modem router settings or Windows security? So it is on the modem router configuration that I was talking about, and it'll be off by default. I've never seen a router where it was turned on by default, but again, check it. Make sure it's turned off. Remote administration will expose a web server to the internet, okay? And so hackers will find it, and they will try to break into your network, whether it's through a brute force attack where they just try different passwords, or if there may be security vulnerabilities in your router, they may be able to exploit them if you have that web interface exposed to the internet. So make sure it is turned off. And that was it for there. So if there are any questions about that, if anybody has not come to my presentation or needs additional information, if you go in, look at your modem router manual, it should have all the instructions on there. If you have a hard time finding it, by all means, email me, tell me your make and model of router. I can download the manual over the internet, and I can give you guidance step by step of how to get in, what screen to look for, and what changes to make on that. So email me if you need that.
Okay, I don't see any particular questions there, Chris. Okay, so moving along. So some discussion in the members forum recently about access to past presentations. And all of the presentations that we have are available on the website. Past presentations from our monthly meeting, they're basically split into recent presentations the last couple of years and earlier presentations. And the Q&A sessions, again, if you go to the main webpage, you'll find the most recent PowerPoint file, audio recording, and the chat window. But we also have an archive where you can identify topics of interest and get access to all of the different files. And it's pretty easy to do. If you go to the main webpage and you scroll down a little bit, or maybe even on your screen, all scheduled meetings, if you click on this link right here, it will take you to the upcoming events. And our webmaster, Bridget Lord, has been busy and has made a shiny new blue button, which I highlight here in red. If you hit the past presentations button, it will take you to a second web page. And as I said, all of the current presentations, typography from May the 12th, for example, and all the previous presentations this year are listed there, and you have access to the PowerPoint presentation, the PDF file, the audio recording, and the chat file, the text file from the chat window. And if you scroll a bit further down, then there's 2020. You can open that and see what presentations there were. And then at the bottom of that section is another link to archive presentations. And these are the previous years, so years before 2020. And if you click on that, then you'll find that there's a whole raft of information about the dates of the presentations, the presenter, and what the topic was, and quite a lot of them have links to their presentation, their association, whatever. So there's lots of information on the meeting presentations. As I said, if you go to the Q&A page and you scroll down a little bit, you'll get to the links for the most recent Q&A session. So this is last week's PowerPoint audio recording and chat file. And then a bit further down the page there, the next line, it says, for the contents of previous sessions, please consult our list of topics. And if you click on the link or list of topics, then it will take you to a page where all the topics for all the past meetings are listed. So you can search on that page for any issue that's of interest to you. And all of the dates for the various meetings are actually hyperlinks. So if, for example, you are interested in KeePass, the auto type function, if you click on March the 17th, then it will take you to the page which has got all the recordings, and it links directly to this page. And then if you click on PowerPoint or the audio recording or the chat, you can access those individual files. So both the regular meeting information and the Q&A sessions, everything's available on the website. All you have to do is just look for it. Okay, so we have about 5 minutes before we turn everything off. Any other questions, comments, or things that people would like to share with the group? Again, you have to unmute your microphone to talk or put something in the chat window. Well, we've answered everybody's questions, Chris.
It sort of looks like that, eh? Well, we'll give it some time. We've got 3 minutes before our end of the hour, but we've often gone over the hour, too, if anybody has anything.
Just looking at Tom in the chat had said he suggests timeouts for Wi-Fi. Should be every hour rather than every day.
Tom, what timeouts are you talking about there?
There's a timeout on Wi-Fi that changes the key that uses. And I think the default is every day, and I believe I've set it to every hour. And that way, if people, it is possible to crack, K-R-A-C-K, Wi-Fi passwords if you really try hard. And this way, it only lasts for an hour or less rather than, a day or less as is the default.
Yeah, I thought that the timeouts only applied to TKIP rather than if you're using AES. Do you know if that's the case?
Tom, you have to unmute your mic.
I don't know about TKIP, so I don't know for sure what that's used.
You also suggested using daisy chain routers. Any specific reason for that?
Yes, if you have, as most people have, I would suggest here, several routers, you can actually kind of layer them so that you have the one that's given to you by your your ISP, which you basically have to use. But you can also have several other routers kind of behind it, linked to it by, a cable. But then you have the possibility of having kind of more layers in between you and the outside world. And so you can have, for example, your outside router handling all your Internet of Things devices, and then you have another router kind of inside that you use for your PC and your phone, which has gives you an extra layer of firewall in between you and the outside. And the same thing for if you have a guest router. If you have a guest network, often those are kind of virtual networks rather than physical networks. So I would suggest you would put them on the same level as your IoT devices at the very kind of outside, so they have less and less access to stuff that's inside, such as your PC or your phone. And if you have several routers, you can do this one after the other. And it does, I suppose it slows things down if you're a gamer, but it gives you more protection, because now if anybody really tries to want to get in for ransomware or something, then they have to not only penetrate your initial router, they have to penetrate the routers after that to get actually into what's valuable for them.
Caution just a little bit on that, in that IP addressing can get a little bit tricky when you have multiple routers in particular. If one of them turns into a switch or something like that, it isn't, but then that doesn't afford you the extra protection on that. So be a little bit careful on your IP addressing.
10 dot is your friend.
Yeah. We had a comment as well from Joss. If the Wi-Fi becomes disabled, how do you start it again? A wired connection would be the way that you would go. And if for some reason your wired connection is blocked for whatever reason, if you're doing, you know, something like MAC address filtering or something, and you're not able to connect on a wired connection, then your reset button is about your only option at that point. But the first thing to try would be wired.
But the timeout that Tom is talking about, it would disable the Wi-Fi from the router? Is that
no? No. He's talking about it. It's a thing where the encryption keys get changed periodically, automatically, and the devices will all renegotiate things correctly. So you don't actually ever see that happen. But it's strictly about the way that the passwords for the encryption is handled. And I think it only applies to TKIP, which is an older standard. Most people nowadays are running version 2 of the protocols and that. And so in that case, you'd be running AES. I don't think it applies to AES, but I could be wrong on that.
Okay, thank you.
And to answering Glenn's question on how to do file sharing in the Linux, I did a quick Google search and found an article on How to Geek. Basically, it tells you how to set up the Windows share, and then they used, I believe it was CIFS Utilities, a Linux program, to do the file sharing. CIFS is essentially a variant on SMB. It's a later file sharing protocol. So that kind of makes sense. But as I say, I've never actually tried to do it, so you'd have to check the details to really know.
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't see anything new in the chat window. So to wrap up, just to remind you, things coming up. Tech Cafe at the library is Lawrence Patterson on June the 7th at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It's a Monday, talking about password phrasing. And I remind you, you have to log in with the library to get the to register for that program. They will send you the credentials for their Zoom session. And our next regular meeting is the 9th of June, which will be the origins of educational technology by the CEO of One Laptop Per Child. And our next meeting is next Wednesday, May 26th. Will just be a regular Q&A session. So again, send in your questions and answer any of the questions that we post ahead of time or topics that you want to share. And I'll be in touch with all you people who volunteered to do things. So you can look forward to that. Well, thanks very much, everyone. Hope you enjoyed it, and good evening.
Thanks, folks. We'll see you next week.